Worried about letting someone else pick out the perfect avocado for your perfect impress them on the third date guacamole? Well, good thing Instacart shoppers are as picky as you are. They find ripe avocados like it's their guac on the line. They are milk expiration date detectives. They bag eggs like the 12 precious pieces of cargo they are. So let Instacart shoppers overthink your groceries so that you can overthink what you'll wear on that third date. Download the Instacart app to get free delivery on your first three orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
Hi, I'm Lauren Sherman, the host of Fashion People. I love fashion, obviously, but shopping for fashion online is kind of annoying. There's endless scrolling, my size is always out of stock, and I can't actually find what I want. No one has really made this work for me. That is until List. Instead of browsing different stores one by one, on List you can see and shop all of the best fashion. List is the secret shopping weapon now used by all my most stylish, cool, and in-the-know friends. Don't shop around. Join 200 million fashion shoppers, including me, on List.com. That's L-Y-S-T. Or download the List app on the App Store today.
It's 5 at 5 with Molly and Hall, where we debate the top 5 sports stories of the day and then open it up to you, the Chicago sports fan. Call us at 312-644-6767, or you can tweet your thoughts at Molly Hall. 5 at 5 with Molly and Hall starts now.
MLB players reportedly plan to counter the owner's financial proposal with a suggestion of a 100-plus game season that includes prorated salaries. Is that a serious offer or one designed to be as insulting as they found the owner's offer? And how will they get to common ground?
Yeah, you know, I think that's a bid for more money, if I'm not mistaken. If they're going to prorate over 100 games, and I guess there would be room for 100 games, then they're asking for more money out of the owners. And I don't know if it's designed. I don't know if there's an insult to it, but clearly they were insulted by the first offer. And again, this is called negotiating, okay? The owners make an offer. They try to split the union up with the idea that, we're gonna pass on the 1% payments to the 1% of baseball and see how you like it, and we'll pay everyone else what they would normally have coming. So it was a clever way of kind of undercutting the union, and the union's response is, oh, well, you know, instead of prorated for 82 games, we'll get prorated for over 100. How's that sound? So these are not, in my opinion, serious grounds for discussion. It just seems like these are shots across the bow, back and forth, and then we're going to get into more serious conversation. The real issue here is that they're running out of time. There is a time element involved in this, and they need to find something that they can agree upon and a methodology of getting to a compromise, which, again, doesn't seem like they're heading in that direction. But it's early. It's negotiating. It's offer, counteroffer, and then maybe now we'll get a serious counter to the counter.
Well, I think you're right, Molly. As time is winding down, that's when they seem to kind of find that common ground, no matter what sports negotiation, individual player to a team, or the collective bargaining agreement that just happened. The lesser time they have to get it done, it seems like they come to sides. But I also think a shot across the bow is also the right way to put it, because anytime negotiation starts, like I said, individually or group wise, every time they come out of that first negotiating session, they call it insulting every time. And so I think that's just part of the terminology they use to put out there in the media to have everybody take their side with or against the players, with or against the owners. But I do think this is probably the most unique negotiating they've ever had to take part in because of what's going on. I think the owners have to treat the players fair. If they're going to put themselves in a compromising position when they're gathered around other people, they have to be able to make sure they're giving the players financial incentive to go out there. And I know a lot of these guys are multi-millionaires, but this is probably the most unique season they've ever negotiated, getting them back on the field. And so I think the two sides have to come to an agreement. I think they will come to an agreement, because the poor older guys do not want to lose out on a season. Because if you're 37 or 38 or John Lester, if you're kind of closer to the end than the beginning, you need your body to keep going in that motion. Once you take it out of the sport for a year's time, getting it back as an older player is as really difficult.
Well, to me, you know, if they're going to play 82 games, then they should be paid for 82 games and on a prorated level. If they're going to play 100 games, they should be paid for playing 100 games. I don't know if there's any particular language in these contracts that says that gives the owners of the team the right to, you know, take so much away during these unprecedented times. And obviously this is, it's very weird and it's not anything that anybody expected, but I think that baseball players should be paid for the number of games that they're going to be playing. It's I feel like I'm maybe oversimplifying it in some way, but unless there's some sort of contract language that says we're allowed to deduct massive portions of your salary if nobody comes to the games or buys hot dogs or beers or overpriced fleece coats or anything like that, then it's just really simple to me to just prorate the salaries. And I know why the owners don't want to do it, but one side's going to budge eventually. I'm not sure when that's going to be, and I'm not sure which side it's going to be. I would probably guess that the owners will probably budge first, because the players themselves are the product, and you can't play games without players, and certainly nobody is going to watch replacement players if it comes to that, and we're all hoping that it does not. So I don't feel like this is an insulting offer at all. This is very logical. This just makes sense to me.
I believe that this reported offer is a serious one, too. Look, the players want a bigger piece of the pie than what's being offered to them. Now, granted, the pie is smaller. Everybody knows that's going to be the case. But the players want what is fair to them. It goes back to what Scott Boras said a couple of weeks ago. You don't privatize the gains and socialize the losses. And he pointed out the increase in the franchises, the increase that's been happening over years around most of the major league teams. Now, I know some of them have been struggling, but for the most part, there have been gains by these teams. So, yeah, that's the thing here. How do you get common ground? It's going to have to be the owners agreeing to pay what the players believe is fair. Now, maybe there will be another back and forth, and we'll get down to a lower number, but this is what the players believe is fair.
Mully nailed it in the beginning. This is a negotiation. The trouble is, and that's what this is, but they don't have the time. This isn't the time to try to redo the CBA that's coming up next year, I believe. You can't do that right now. And yeah, you're right. You know, they want 82. The owners say 82. Players say 100. Maybe they meet in the middle, but the clock is ticking. Tick, 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 tick. You know, it's bad enough you get a Cleveland-Chicago World Series, and you're crossing your fingers that the game doesn't get snowed out. So what in the world are you going to do if you try to get in 100 games and you don't start till, I mean, there's no, how are they going to start on July 4th at this point, right? That's not achievable. If they agreed tomorrow, I don't think July 4th would be achievable. The pitchers wouldn't be ready. So these two sides got to get together, and they've got to do it quickly.
That is an unbelievably great question.
What do you think of MLB super agent Scott Boras' email to his clients that was obtained by the Associated Press, where he advises players not to bail out the owners and insists games can't be played without you? He also told players not to agree to further pay cuts. Does Boras saying let owners take some of their record revenues and profits from the past several years and pay you the prorated salaries encapsulate the player's position? And if so, how do the owners get around it?
You know, one thing about Scott Boras is Scott Boras is not representing the majority. What does he have, 73 players in Major League Baseball? And he's representing the richest of the rich. And those guys can make easy decisions about not compromising on, you know, talking to the owners or how the owners want to, you know, try to get this baseball season in motion. Yeah, it's easy to look at the past and look at how much money some of these franchises have made and connect it to the future and the salaries that he wants. But, you know, when we went on strike in 1987, the richest guys were ready to jump the fence the earliest, and that destroyed our negotiations or our ploy. I think the same thing would happen in Major League Baseball. Scott Boras can tell his clients, yeah, don't give anything back to the owners. But again, like we talked about the first question, this is the most unique, kind of resurgence or restarting of sports that we've ever been through. So, Scott Boras can have his opinion. They always want to interview him and see what his, personal stance is on all these issues. But again, he's representing the richest of the richest and not the guys that are trying to, at least get baseball back in motion.
Yeah, I found it fascinating that the only team that Scott Boras mentioned in his little email to his clients was the Chicago Cubs. And he talked about the idea that that they're worth $3.2 billion, but they have obviously bought the team for $750. Throughout this process, they will be able to claim they never had any profits because those profits went to pay off their loans, is what he wrote. He said, however, the end result is that the Ricketts will have improved assets that significantly increase the value of the Cubs, value not shared by the players. And that's been the argument all along, that as teams argue about game day revenue and losing all of these profits, they actually, if you look at what's happened in Major League Baseball, for 17 consecutive years, they have had increased revenue. And certainly with the Cubs, you buy a franchise for $750 million. It's now worth $3.2 billion. You can't find those kinds of investments anywhere. And look, they're great business people. They've obviously done a great job of creating all sorts of new things, and they've been able to not spend as much money up front as a lot of people might think. It's remarkable what they've been able to do, and it's really a sign of being able to kind of take advantage of the business that you have. Now, how does that apply to the players? It's more about generational wealth for the family than it is for the players. They have taken the baseball revenue and put it back into the team. That's what they tell you all the time. And so if there is no baseball revenue, they don't want to put it back into the team. And that's kind of the position of ownership. But the players are looking at it and saying, hey, listen, at the end of the day, you're going to have a hell of a lot more in your coffers than we are. We are just trying to earn on a year-to-year basis. Now, the amount of money they earn is why the public won't ever get behind them, because people don't look at it and say, well, I'm a small business owner, I'm just like the Ricketts. They look at it and they say, I've had a job, go do your job, you need to work. So it's a very difficult argument to make because of the amount of money they make. But I think it's fascinating what Boras said, and I think that it kind of does encapsulate exactly what the opinion is of the players in the union here.
Yeah, I agree with you, Mully. I really liked reading this statement from Boras yesterday, and I gotta tell you, I was quite tickled by the fact that he singled out the Cubs because of a couple reasons. But I think one of the big reasons is that Tom Ricketts has been so vocal. Maybe it's just because we're in Chicago, but I've seen Tom Ricketts speak more than some of the other owners, and he keeps throwing out that 70% number, which I think most of us believe is BS. I don't believe that whatsoever. So I thought it was very funny that Scott Boras would single them out. And I do think that while, Tom, you make a good point about Boras only representing a small amount of the players, I think by and large, he does have, because he's got his own clients' best interests in mind, I think then by proxy, he's got all of the players' interests in mind. And he's always trying to get the most money and the biggest benefits and the highest priority for his clients. And I think that will reflect the opinion of most of the players. Now, if you're a guy, 25th, 26th man on the roster, and you're kind of teetering between the bigs and AAA, and you're not making that big money, you might have a different opinion. But I think by and large, Scott Boras's opinions are that of the players and the reps in the Players Association.
I liked what Scott Boras had to say. And, I understand that it would suck if there is no season for the players that don't make the most money, as Kevin pointed out, the 26th guy on the roster or whatever. But look at what Major League Baseball owners are beginning to do to the minor leagues. I mean, I think players need to just, you know, get behind this thinking that they need to get what is fair. That, you know, I mean, there's no point to giving in at this point. I believe you gotta go for that bigger piece of the pie and get what is fair to you. So I like what Scott Boras had to say, and I hope that, you know, this unifies this players union to be a little even stronger.
I don't necessarily dislike what he said, but I could see the other side of this, where this could actually divide the union even more. To Tom's point, he represents the elite of an already elite group, and we've seen that the top guys are being asked to take a far bigger pay cut than the guys that are making in the $600,000 a year range. Now, Kevin, I think, is right. I don't think I would want to watch, air quotes, scab players. Like, let's put it this way. The guys that I, every, you know, once or twice last summer, I went out to the Chicago Dogs out by the airport. I went and saw those games. Fun experience, great place for the kids, cheap beer, cheap hot dog, yada, yada, yada. You know, if those guys are playing on Marquee Network and on The Score, I don't know that I'm tuning in to listen to Pat and Ron call that, or to watch Len call those guys playing baseball. I don't think it's going to work. You need the players. You absolutely have to have them. But at the same time, there are if there is no Major League Baseball, and I wish we heard this with Harold Reynolds yesterday. Mully and I talked about it after the show. I was shocked when Harold said, you know, after the 94 strike and they missed that World Series, there were hundreds of guys, including himself, that never played Major League Baseball again because that time was lost. So for some of these guys, even at a reduced rate, they're never going to get this money back if these sides don't come together. And I think you need to think about those guys when you're thinking about this clearly.
You know, Dave, it's a good question.
NFL owners tabled an onside kick alternative for the second straight year despite a precipitous drop in the conversion rate of onside kicks. Why not make a change, and would you like to see it happen?
You know, I'd love to see it happen, but I worry that it's the unintended consequences. I think that's what they're thinking. If you are a team that has the capability of converting a fourth and 15, I guess it would ultimately be, then everybody would have to become a team that could convert a fourth and 15. And, you know, you look at a team like the Kansas City Chiefs that has a high-powered offense and doesn't worry about their defense. Would that become every team in the NFL? Would there be more of that going on? And I don't know that that's a terrible idea, because people love that kind of football. But I you know, when we watch some of these, what would you call it? Almost they're almost like these video game type games. Everybody talks about, well, that's the greatest game. There's not like a lick of defense. It's too one-sided a version of the game, and I think that might be the concern. But the fact of the matter is that they went from converting onside kicks at about a 16% rate to about a 10% rate. So that's not something you want to have teams have an effort to get back in a game, and that's not something that is working. And in fact, the drop has been significant. So maybe they need to come up with something else. But it always is the same thing. You always worry about unintended consequences when you change the game, and maybe it's wise to table this one.
Well, you know what, I'm all for the onside kick to stay in it, Molly and you guys, because, you know, so if you give them a fourth and 15, then you go out there, you break the huddle, and you got Allen Robinson at over 6 foot. You got Jimmy Graham at 6'7". You put Cole Kmet out there at 6'6". So all I'm going to do is, I think this invites pass interference calls when you have an undermanned defensive player on a bigger receiver. So you say, okay, run into the shoes, run into the toes of that defender, and I'm going to throw you the ball. Jump up, and then hopefully it'll create more pass interference calls. Because, you know, in the NFL, the most calls on pass interference is first and 10. So you get those bigger plays that you get defensive backs a little herky-jerky because they have that run threat option. Here, when it's just a pass threat, when you're going fourth and 15th, I think he will invite more pass interference calls. And one thing about an onside kick is investigated during the course of the week because they see a vulnerability on the line of scrimmage of kickoff return men. You find a guy that leaves a little bit too early, bam, there's your spot. So what are you going to do? If you can't onside kick at the fourth quarter to win a game, are you going to take away the coaches that kick these onsides in the first, second, or third quarter? Because what you're doing is you're taking away good investigative work by the special teams coach that sees that vulnerability. To me, they've made the onside kick more fair when they made the distribution of players separate on each side of the football. There is not a guy that's going to be attacked by more than one body. So I think they've added the safety element into the onside kick. I think it's the anticipation of the result is really exciting because it could, you know, mean a win or a loss for whichever team gets it. And again, I like, you know, the first, second, third quarter threat of an onside kick if they see that there's exposure to it.
Yeah, you know, I'm all for offense. You know, I don't want to watch a football game where the final score is 6-3 or anything like that. But I think that the proposed rule change might be a little bit too radical for right now, for me anyway. I think it changes the game maybe a little bit too much, and it gives an even bigger advantage to teams that have excellent quarterback play. I think maybe if the Bears had a decent quarterback, we would all be in favor of this rule because it would give them another shot to move the ball. But the Bears have a lot of trouble moving the ball, let alone 15 yards on a one and done attempt. So I think that you know, the onside kick is an exciting play. I think it's always kind of a cool thing to see when you randomly get one during the course of a game. So I think that while this is interesting, and I'd be willing to hear more data and stuff that goes into it and more discussion about it, I think right now it is probably a good idea to table it.
According to CBS Sports, Rich McKay, the chair of the league's competition committee, said during a conference call yesterday, "I think there's definitely the theory that you don't want to make the comeback too easy. You've worked all game to be ahead. You would not want a rule to come and change that and say all of a sudden we're going to completely change the odds of the game that you were able to preserve the lead and now it's blown." So I think that's the theory from the owners. You don't want to make the comeback too easy. And that's the exact reason I would want to see it happen. I agree with Tom. I think it would make games exciting at the end of game to have the chance of a team to make this surprise comeback. So I would love to see it happen. I hate to see it tabled for a second straight season.
I'm not sure why you table it. If you brought it up, couldn't you force teams to do it in preseason and see how it works and then vote quickly on it in between like the third preseason game and the start of the NFL season? I mean, you're not going to have a different, I don't think, and you guys can tell me I'm wrong, and it happens quite often, or the textures will tell us, is there going to be a special player for a fourth and 15 play that wouldn't be on the roster if you only had onside kicks? I mean, the NFL is not broken. I mean, it could always get better. There's always complaints. I'm at the front of the line to complain and bitch and moan about things. But the NFL is not broken. So this is like tinkering just to tinker? And if it is, then fine. Throw it in the preseason. Or roll it down the river and ask the college guys. Okay, maybe in the big Power 5 conferences they're not going to do it. But, I mean, David's not here today. But how about the MAC? How about roll it into the MAC conference? If the MAC teams are playing MAC teams, let's see them do it. Let's see how it works out. It would be more exciting. I agree. But again, the NFL is a great product. Leave it alone.
Well, I think that's a great question. And for us, it's pretty easy.
Do you see any scenario in which Mitchell Trubisky stays with the Bears if he's not the starter next year? Is Trubisky's future in Chicago at stake in the so-called quarterback competition?
Is his future at stake? Yes, you know, because every single player, whether it's the quarterback or the offensive tackle, if they're the starter and they're expecting to receive a big payday and they're not performing at the level that's expected of them, then you're making the decision for the team. So, you know, could Mitch come back if he was not the starter? I'm not so sure because I think the language according to Nick Foles' contract, if we're assuming that Nick Foles is the healthy starter, if Mitchell Trubisky is not, then you're going to have to make some financial decisions at the quarterback positions accordingly. And so will the agent go there and accept the contract if Mitchell Trubisky's not the starter to take veteran minimum? No, because you got to go back to past experiences. And I always bring it up because in my era, I watched Steve Young fail in the USFL, have a really tough time with the Tampa Bay Buccaneers, and then go to San Francisco and sit behind Joe Montana with Bill Walsh for a couple years, and he emerged into the Hall of Famer that he became when he became a starter at 30 years old. So I just think it's, you know, quarterbacks in every position move. If you're not living up to the expectations where you were drafted, and I think quarterback is probably the easiest position to get clear evidence whether you deserve the opportunity or not.
Yeah, I think that's a great point, Tom. I think you've nailed it here. I look at Mitch and I think, you know, what fans don't want is to understand that sometimes when you're drafted into the wrong place, be it the wrong coach, the wrong system, whatever it might be, it's not uncommon for players to not be able to succeed and then to move on and succeed somewhere else. You know, we talk about Alex Smith as an example of that, you know, really running into major problems in San Francisco, gets on the field too early, was a turnover machine as a younger player, and then winds up in Kansas City with the right coaches around him in the right system and fits it and has success. I think that that's the fear that some fans have, that Mitch is good enough to have himself a nice career. He just wasn't seasoned enough to be able to play in Chicago immediately when he got here, and everything was put upon him because, of course, you traded up to get him, and there are other players in that draft that have been significantly better than him. So he's going to be judged in that fashion. It would be great if you could say, all right, Mitch, we're going to give you a little time now. We'll help you get ready. We're going to do. We're going to let this other guy play, and then you can stick around. The thing is, when you turn down a guy's option year, that you're telling him you're not willing to pay. He hasn't earned the big money. Now, you know, could he end up playing, and could he end up being a guy that you want to bring back? We've seen that happen before with different teams. We've seen it happen with the Bears, but at the cornerback position. So I don't think that his career is over, but I don't think he'll ever be viewed in the fashion in which he was here in Chicago. Now, you talk about Ryan Tannehill, and could Mitch leave and have success somewhere else? Anything is possible. But the reality is, in the NFL, if you have success, you want to get paid. And if you don't have success at that position, you end up moving somewhere else. And maybe you have success down the line. And when people make comparisons to someone like Alex Smith, they got to remember that he left the team where he didn't have success and had success elsewhere. And I think that's kind of the problem that Mitch is facing. I wouldn't, if he can't win this quarterback competition, he'll be hard pressed to win it. Then I don't know that there is a future for him here because, you know, barring playing time, he's going to look for playing time elsewhere.
Well, I think that if it is indeed an open quarterback competition, and I believe that it is, given everything that's been said here, given the fact that they gave up a draft pick to get Nick Foles, I think they think he's an upgrade, and I think he'll probably have the upper hand in any sort of competition. But, you know, he's been so injury prone in his career that I think Mitch will end up playing next season, maybe even large segments of the season, depending on, you know, how knocked around Nick Foles gets and how his past history will indicate that maybe it'll happen again. So I think that Mitch will get some playing time next year, and I think that it might be his last chance in Chicago. I think another team would be more likely to take a flyer on him at discount rates somewhere along the league. Every team is going to need a quarterback at some point. I mean, there are so few good ones, and I think that even with Mitch's disappointing career that he's had so far here in Chicago, I think another team will probably be more likely to step up and offer Mitch a contract when his deal is up than him being renewed here.
I don't see Trubisky staying in Chicago if he's not the starter next year. There is so much turnover at the quarterback position in the NFL. He shouldn't be content to just settle for a backup spot. I mean, look at look at Ryan Tannehill. I mean, you don't know if Trubisky could have that kind of success like Tannehill had last year, and we don't know if Tannehill's season was a one-off last year. But you never know what can happen if you're given that starting job and you go somewhere else. So I don't see him staying in Chicago as a backup. And his future in Chicago is at stake in this quarterback competition. What's at stake is him being a franchise quarterback for the Bears. And if he doesn't succeed and he loses the job to Foles, I think he's out of here.
This is a great posed question, and we're fortunate to have Tom here to get into this more. And Mully, ironically, and we did not talk about this, but last night you were talking about a book, and unfortunately I don't read as many books as you, not even close, read lots of newspapers, but not a lot of books. But I was looking for a TV show to watch, and if you haven't watched it, this is for everybody out there, watch Alex Smith Project 11, E60 by the Four Letter Network. Oh my goodness gracious, and it's a great comp. I mean, to Trubisky, just from the beginning, not what happens to Alex Smith once he gets to his fourth team, I believe. Not for the faint of heart if you haven't seen it, but fascinating television, just great stuff. But I think the one thing that Trubisky has going for him is his athleticism, and I think he was restricted last year, not only by himself, but by the team and by that shoulder, because there was nobody behind him to play the position for a couple games in a row. I think this year is going to belong to Nick Foles. And if Nick Foles can get this Bears team to the postseason and play, you know, 14 of the games and Trubisky helps out a little bit, then maybe Trubisky doesn't have a future. But if maybe Mitch can learn something from this guy. And if Mitch is healthy, he's going to have a job in this league. Maybe not as a starter, but he's going to have a job in this league.
It's a great question.
Do you believe that the eventual NHL and NBA champions will need an asterisk next to their accomplishment? What about Major League Baseball? Does it depend on which team wins their respective title? What is the best argument that they will be authentic or illegitimate champions?
Yeah, you know, I think we're living in a different time, and it's going to be very interesting to see how people accept these champions. What's going to happen is that initially we're going to feel like, God, look at that season, what a fluke. And then eventually, as time passes, we won't look back and think, well, look what happened with San Antonio. Or, hey, wow, the Washington Redskins won two championships in shortened seasons. We're going to say, my God, you know, look how great a coach Pop is. Look how he was able to do so many things. We're going to say, you know, you look at the Redskins and you think, Joe Gibbs, man, if there was ever any kind of avenue for success, he found it. He could win with three different quarterbacks. He could win whenever you had some kind of labor issue, whenever there was something to take advantage of, he did it. So I think that's the way this will end up happening. Even if the, you know, like, and again, wild scenario, suppose the Blackhawks just upset their way to a title, we wouldn't look at it and say, wow, you know, in 10 years, we won't say, wow, that, remember that horrible whatever tournament they had? We're going to say, man, that team was so good. They won three titles, and then even in all the face of this stuff, they came back for a fourth. It's just the passage of time that will solve these issues, and there'll be no need for an asterisk.
Yeah, I agree. You know, the teams can only accomplish what they're facing. It's not like they're going to have one baseball team play 100 games and then another team play 45 and still get into the playoffs. Every team is going to have the same starting line. And one thing about the asterisk, you know, if you look at the asterisk in baseball, you know, yeah, should we put an asterisk next to the juice baseball era? Should we put an asterisk next to the steroid era guys? You know, and they're all so reluctant to do that. They just keep the players out of the Hall of Fame, and they won't admit to a juice baseball. And so it's, again, it's such a unique scenario in every single sport. Every single team can only accomplish what the league sets in front of them. So, yeah, is it an authentic championship? Yeah, according to, you know, according to what they were playing, you know, what they were given, the guidelines they were given to play. So, yeah, asterisk, no. But, you know, I think the championships, whatever they're faced with, will be legitimate.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's legitimate as well. We're literally living in like a very long chapter of a history book right now. So anytime anybody looks back on anything, sports or otherwise, in the year 2020, be like, oh, yeah, that was the year when all that funky stuff went down. So whether it's Major League Baseball, NBA, NHL, I think, you know, we're all understanding of these circumstances right now. I don't think we need to throw any asterisks in there unless the Cubs win the World Series, then it doesn't count.
If a champion is crowned, whether it be the NHL, the NBA, MLB, it's legitimate. It's authentic. I mean, we face a scenario where we might get one sport in if we're lucky, maybe two. Maybe there's a scenario where things get worse and we don't have sports, and I hope that doesn't happen. But if there's a champion crowned, they are legitimate. I don't want to hear otherwise. I mean, we have to be grateful if we get any of these sports in and no asterisk needed.
Grateful if we get these sports in as well put, Ray. No asterisk. The only asterisk that will be needed is if the first couple letters of that word will apply to the both sides of MLB if they can't. That will be the asterisk. There will be an asterisk on that sport if they don't play while these other teams compete. That's where the asterisk will be long at 6 o'clock.
312-644-6767. That's the telephone number. It's Mully and Haw. He's Tom Thayer on Chicago Sports Radio 670 The Score.
You could spend the weekend doing the same old whatever, or you could conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.